卵の殻を破らねば、ひな鳥は生まれずに死んでいく。我らがひなだ。卵は世界だ。世界の殻を破らねば、我らは生まれずに死んでいく。世界の殻を破壊せよ。
世界を革命するために。
Welcome once again to the Shadow Play Gaze for our actual inaugural episode. Before we get into talking about episode one of Revolutionary Girl Utena, The Rose Bride, we're going to try to give you all the listeners some like trigger warnings for subjects that may come up in this episode, given the events of the episode. And I think a good one is... abuse of like a significant other, or just like hitting someone. Obviously that happens in the episode, so that subject will come up if that's something that makes you uncomfortable. Obviously, just fair warning that's kind of going to be in play this episode. I'm really excited to get started on this 39 episode journey with my co-host Christine Palin, and I am of course Derek Reining. So Christine actually wanted to give the listeners a little rundown of some of the artistic influences that went into the show before we really get into the meat of the episode. So Christine, please take it away.
Yeah, because I realized in our intro episode, we almost forgot to tell people where to watch it. I realized we didn't really talk about some of the broader strokes of the artistic influences behind the show. So I did want to like at least give a few of those references in case any of our listeners want to do some research on their own and learn more about these things. So I think we mentioned last episode that we will not be talking about the manga much, but Chiyo Saito, who did the manga for Utena, is a really important figure in shaping the visual language of the show. Because she, along with Shinya Hasegawa, are the individuals chiefly behind the character designs and the general like look of these characters. So I wanted to kind of just talk briefly about Chiyo Saito's relationship with the Takarazaka Review. For those of us who don't know what that is, the Takarazaka Review is an all-female musical theater troupe based in Takarazaka, Japan, and it's been around since 1913. The troupe adapts, Japanese works, Japanese literature, manga, various, Japanese works, but also a lot of Western works, novels, musicals, operas, plays, and movies. I found a clip on YouTube, the most interesting one I found. They did an adaptation of a musical, all-female musical adaptation of Oliver Stone's JFK.
Oh, good.
So there's clips of that on YouTube if you want to watch. It's really fascinating. And so I'm not an expert on it, but I highly encourage everyone to kind of like look it up and see what it looks like, because Chiyo Saito grew up wanting to be in the Takarazaka Review. I found an interview, I think it was her note for the one of the stage adaptations of Utena, writer's note about the musical adaptation. And she grew up wanting to be in the Takarazaka Review, and she herself says it very much influenced her art style. As an aside, Sailor Moon fans might also be aware that Naoko Takeuchi is also big into the Takarazaka Review. Haruka and Michiru were at least partially inspired by it. I think she originally envisioned them to be in it, but then didn't include that, but I think she has said that they were at least partially inspired by that. And the reason I bring this up is because theater in general is really important to Utena and the narrative of Utena and, the visual cues of Utena. And I'm not an expert on Takarazaka in particular, but I just wanted to kind of bring that up as a potential visual touchstone for this show, because Chiyo Saito was certainly interested in it, and I think other individuals involved in the creation of the show were interested in it. So look it up. Look at some of the costumes and the way these women look in these adaptations. And it's also important to note that Utena has been made into a series of musical adaptations, including the one in 1997 that was an all-female cast. Like, all the male characters in the show were played by women. So that's an important note. And then another potential visual touchstone is the anime Rose of Versailles. Have you seen Rose of Versailles?
No, I've just seen on Tumblr. Just like being an anime fan, I think people have seen Rose of Versailles whether they know it or not. Pretty much anyone with like these big dewy eyes and like long flowing hair and these sort of like 18th century garb. Yeah, so I've seen Rose of Versailles, but I've never like actually sat down and watched it.
You've perceived it.
Yes, I've absorbed it through just knowing anime.
So yeah, Rose of Versailles was a manga and then later anime that ran from 1979 to 1980. And I believe the genre, it's like Marie Antoinette's like adolescence. And there's a main character on that who is very gender nonconforming, it's a woman, but like very much dresses like a quote unquote man. And it's my understanding, I did find that Ikahara has like said that Utena is not inspired by Rose of Versailles. Like, I guess in one of the director's commentaries for DVD, he like vehemently denies it apparently. I've not listened to it, so I cannot confirm exactly what he says, but I did see that he's apparently denied it. But if you look it up, I encourage, again, people look it up. At the very least, there are visual connections between the two works. Again, at the very least, they're working within the same genre with similar aesthetics, even if those connections weren't necessarily intentional. But again, as we mentioned last episode, a lot of people worked on the show, and I do think it's very likely that there's at least unintentionally DNA of Rose of Versailles.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, like Rose of Versailles is like a huge, like if you were alive in Japan and like watched anime or read manga or anything at all, you for sure knew Rose of Versailles. So it's funny that he's just like straight up said no influence. But maybe that's just like you said, maybe that's true for him. But it's hard to deny the connection between the two.
Yeah.
Yeah, so those both make sense to me. I knew about the Rose of Versailles, but the theater, the all-female theater, to me, was not something I thought about. I knew, obviously, that Utena has been adapted into plays before, but I wasn't aware of the specific troupe. And so that, like you said, it's very fitting that this very first episode begins with a curtain being drawn up.
Yes.
I instantly caught that. That's... just to kind of establish this idea of a sort of unreality or a sort of amplified reality of memory in this case, because we start with what seems like a fairy tale at first, but it turns out to be an actual flashback for our main character.
Yeah, so I think it's really interesting and obviously very intentional that the first time we meet Utena is in the past. We meet her in the past and in this very... idealized fairy tale like version of the past. Again, like you said, it's presented as this storybook story. Again, in like the curtain is very intentional, but that is her, at least some version of her past. And I think this is probably the time to say, we mentioned this last episode, that Utena was a very relatively low budget show, and this sequence is going to be one of the what Derek called the sum of the repeated animation sequences in the show. We'll see this again, but repeating sequences like this obviously, yes, saves money, but what is repeated is important. And the fact that the show opens with introducing us to Utena in this specific way, and that this is going to be something we see again, is important.
Absolutely. It helps reestablish like what Utena's motivations are. And my favorite little touch that I noticed on this watch was that touch being the operative word, because there are two moments where we sort of switch away from this sort of flat, like storybook sort of visual into this sort of gauzy, glowy, like quote unquote real, in terms of like what the anime is presenting as like reality. And those two moments are when I believe we get two different touches from the prince to Utena. And the one specifically that I'm thinking of is when he presents her the ring with the rose crest on it. So I thought it was very interesting that these two moments of touch are kind of what feel the most real to Utena in that moment. Or at least that was my interpretation of why the sort of art style switches in those moments.
Yeah, gosh. This is my third time watching the show through, and I hadn't noticed that. And even this time, I watched this episode like three times this weekend to take notes on various things. But like, I didn't even notice that. But I did notice it, but I didn't think about it. But that is where we go from this like storybook style to the more normal style animation of the show. And yeah, that's significant. Then it's the moments when this moment of connection with her and the prince.
Right. But it is interesting to note that we still don't get any eyes in either art styles. Obviously, we get this sort of flat silhouette, I guess, is the kind of word you would use to describe how the figures are presented to us. Like, all black, obviously, like, the clothes and backgrounds and stuff are very colorful, but, like, the figures themselves are, like, pitch black with no facial expressions. And then even when we get those little moments of more realistic, we still don't see any eyes or anything to sort of signify identity. We know it's Utena because she is the only character with pink hair that we see, which is helpful. But, yeah, otherwise, these two figures could be really anyone, if you, like, it's, which adds to the sort of fairy tale effect of it.
So we meet Utena in the past, and then when we jump to the present, we still don't meet her for a couple minutes, because our first moment in the present is with a girl whose name we come to learn as Wakaba, waiting for her quote-unquote boyfriend, who seems to have ditched her. We know this is going to be Utena, because, you know, there's this this first episode's so great. I love the way everything is introduced. It's such a great first episode. I just wanted, can we talk, I'm obsessed with Wakaba calling Utena her boyfriend.
Absolutely. Like, that is, I love it so much. And I love that everyone else at the school clearly understands their relationship too. Like, we get these two girls who walk up to Wakaba, and they sort of mock her for waiting for Utena, because according to them, Utena is already up at the school. I do also love that the first line the Wakaba says is she's late, and it's almost like she's talking about, she's like kind of knows that Utena is our main character, so it's like kind of the show being like, I can't believe our main character isn't here yet. So I love that moment with Wakaba, and I love Wakaba in general.
You go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say, I'm glad that the main motivation for kind of what kicks off the story is that Utena is defending Wakaba's honor. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what leads Utena to go duel Saionji in the first place. Obviously, Anthe's abuse, like, kind of factors into it, but that's the inciting incident of the show, really.
Oh, yeah, like, we'll get into this more later, but, like, yeah, Utena falls, like, ass backwards into the plot of the story just because she's, like, pissed on Wakaba's behalf. Like, she's no clue what she's doing. It's just because she cares about Wakaba. And it's, like, she's so kind-hearted. And I love Utena. I love her so much. I think she's such a great character. And I love her introduction scene. It's so, like, I love the observation about, like, you know, she's late, because it's like, she's so obviously the main character, and that the scene with the teacher is so obviously main character in a shoujo anime scene, because she's getting criticized by this comically mean teacher for her choice of uniform, who calls it a weird getup, and Utena says, it looks good on all the other boys here, but, like, none of the other boys are wearing that uniform. No one is wearing anything remotely close to what Utena's wearing, and I think that's, like, kind of, I take that as, like, kind of a fun reference to the fact that, like, the main character in the anime always has, like, a very distinct outfit or look.
Yeah, you get the, yeah, there's always those memes of, like, it's usually, like, Bleach, I feel like, of, like, the main character of that show obviously has this bright orange hair, and then there's just, like, a shot of him among these classmates with darker hair, and it's like, I wonder who the main character is, and so, but fortunately for Utena, everyone seems to be very color-coded in this world, at least our main characters. Mm-hmm. And when we are introduced to the, like, main players of the show, we usually get this sort of rose border that will become kind of a motif throughout the show. But it's specifically in this episode, it's used, I noticed, at least, whenever we're introduced to someone who will be important at some point.
Yes, for sure. We're going to be talking a lot about colors on this show.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm really excited about that. But something, I guess, while we're on the subject of these rose borders, I did note that Anthe, as far as I could tell, was really the only one who gets it twice. She gets it when you see her for the first time in her little greenhouse, but then we also get it when she's kind of in her rose bride attire up in the duel arena. So I like that the show is kind of already hinting at this idea of the sort of dual identities of Anthe. Like, we think we meet her at first, but then we meet her a second time, and it's like almost as if it's a completely different character. So I like that little visual cue there.
Yeah, I didn't notice that, but that's clearly hinting at there's a lot more behind this whole dueling thing. Again, Utena has fallen, just completely stumbled into this very complicated thing.
Absolutely. And we love
it. Yeah, we love it. Speaking of me loving Utena, I love the basketball scene so much.
My note on that is strictly all caps ballin. That is my note on the scene.
I am obsessed with like all of her groupies, first of all. And like where they ask it, like the girl like is like, can I give you a towel? And Utena's like, yeah, it's your turn. Like she has like a rotating cast of groupies who like wanna like wipe off her sweat. But then this leads to a really great, very short scene where this one of the guys in the basketball team is trying to get her to join like his like regional team or whatever. And she says, but I'm a girl. And he's like, well, you look like a guy, you act like a guy. But she's like, no, I'm not a guy. I wear this uniform to be a noble prince who saves princesses. And it's really telling that our first two scenes with Utena in the present are entirely about how other people see her, and particularly see her through the context of like the way she dresses, and that like that doesn't necessarily align with how she sees herself.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love that note. And I love that she is specifically, at first you may think, oh, she is intentionally trying to dress like a boy or like a male or not her own gender. But when in that scene in which we aren't seeing this conversation happen in real time, we're seeing it sort of like through these echoes as we watch Utena like walk down a hallway, which I found interesting. But it's kind of telling us that it's not about gender for Utena here. It's purely about trying to be a prince.
Whatever that means.
Exactly. I don't think we quite know what that means. All we know is that to Utena, a prince saves princesses. And so I did also really like that little introductory scene. Not just because of that, but also because we get these really dramatic archways throughout the show, and specifically in this episode. There's a lot of great use of shadow and light in this show, and in this pilot especially. Like, we kind of get this great sort of sunrise moment where a lot of the scenery gets sort of lit up gradually, and so I love that the first time Utena sees Anthy is through an archway beyond a glass like sort of surface. So there's this real sense of distance and disconnect between these two characters, but Utena still manages to see Anthy in that moment.
Yeah, this scene is so interesting to me because when she first sees Anthy, she's on the same level as her. She's on the ground floor. And then, you know, she notices the girl watering flowers and says, you know, the roses remind her of her past. And then it cuts to when we see Anthy being slapped by Seonji. Utena is now above and watching from a window. I say it is almost as if a spectator at the theater. She's watching this like from a distance. She's completely removed. She's not acting in this situation. She's just watching, and she's witnessing Anthy being slapped by a green-haired boy named Seonji and a red-haired guy named Toga. I'm saying this because any first-time viewers will come to learn them by their hair first, and then we'll learn their names. She sees Toga stop him from hitting Anthy again. And I just think it's very deliberate that we suddenly cut from Utena like on the ground to up high watching from a distance. In this moment where if she had been on that same level where she just was seconds ago, would she have intervened? I don't know. It's a very interesting choice of framing that scene.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it almost adds a sort of voyeuristic element to it in when she's above, when, like you said, on the ground level, and we don't really know the chronology of this. Like, this scene could have happened, I guess, at any sort of point. But like you said, there's when Anthy is getting slapped, we see Utena from above, and we do see like Utena like react to that. She says that's going a bit far, but then she gets interrupted by Wakaba in a great scene, just full-on tackling Utena. Very adorable.
Once again, calling her boyfriend.
Yes. I really like this scene. And I also like, we talked about the groupies, but I believe both Wakaba and all of Utena's groupies refer to Utena with the Sama like honorific, which is sort of this in Japanese culture. Sama is like a sort of like reverence, like you're referring to someone in a reverent way when you're using Sama. And that's important not only for Utena here, but it also comes into play too for Seonji and Anthy, as we'll see later when Anthy switches from calling him Seonji Sama to Seonji Senpai, which is presented as just like a slap to the face for him. But I don't know how the dub plays that.
I should check that. But like, yeah, because I did watch this episode. I think she just says my classmate, like, because that's how it's done in the sub. So I'm guessing maybe I don't know. I can't remember. But
right,
that's something that you can't quite translate the significance of that shift.
Right, like you kind of get the sense of like, yeah, she's now referring to no longer as like Master Saionji, but it's like it's very deeply rooted in this very like specific part of the Japanese language, which is honorifics. So hopefully if you like people were watching that were like wondering why he reacts so like aghast in that moment when she calls him that, it's because of this. It's like she instantly is only referring to him in this very sort of distanced, like that's something you would just call like someone who you go to school with, would be like senpai. So yeah, I like that. Language is already very important in the show.
Yeah, and while we're here at the scene with Wakaba and Utsuna, I did want to bring up, for especially for first time viewers, so the school Otori Academy has an elementary school, a middle school, and a high school, and Utsuna, Wakaba, Anthy, and some more characters we'll meet are in the middle school. They're all about 14, and we've met Saionji and Toga, and they're in high school. I'd had that in my notes because I remember my first watch being a little confused, like exactly the ages of everyone. So we're going to meet characters a variety of ages on the show, but Wakaba, Anthy, and Utsuna are all 14 in like 7th or 8th grade.
Right. So that also adds another whole element of sort of power dynamics here, where we've got these younger women. We haven't really met anyone who's any boys Utena's age that really matter. But we have met quite a few older men, especially the only two like older classmates named in this episode are two men. So it's just an interesting sort of note there that we're adding on age in addition to gender and like just physical stature in terms of like these power dynamics going on there. I also do love that this greenhouse or this sort of, I guess that's what you'd call it, that we've been talking about is also very like distinctly a birdcage shape. Just something interesting to note. And I do believe Tori, T-O-R-I, like that part of Otori means bird. So make of that what you will, but there's already some sort of like birdcage imagery associated with Anthy here.
So in this scene, we also learn that Wakaba has a crush on Saionji. And Utsuna kind of teases her for that. And Wakaba's like, you know, you're the only one for me. You're better than all the other, you're better than all the boys. So they have this interesting relationship where they're really good friends. And Wakaba's like infatuated with Utsuna in this way, but she also has this crush on Saionji, this older boy who she's interested in. And this is also where we learned that Toga is the student council president and Saionji is the vice president, and that Anthy is somehow involved. We come to learn that she is the rose bride, and actually the next scene is the student council scene, so we can kind of get into it here.
Right. I do, before we go into the student council, I do like in that moment when you get those introductions, it's interesting that Wakaba introduces Saionji first, and then she talks about Toga, and then Utsuna has to prompt her to introduce Anthy. Like, she doesn't even think to mention Anthy, but that's who Utsuna is like actually asking about in that moment. So I just thought that was really interesting. But yeah, the student council.
Yeah.
I don't believe we get any names for anyone beyond Saionji and Toga in this moment.
No.
We get a blue-haired, presumably a boy, and then a sort of orange-haired girl in this moment. They get the rose borders too, and they're color-coded, so I think that's sort of your big sign that they're going to be important. But unfortunately, they don't get much to do in this episode. But I feel like they leave a pretty big impression pretty quickly.
Yes. And this is, so the student council setting, this is going to be a place where we're going to get a lot of weird symbolism, and we didn't quite get any this episode, but, the conversation was pretty straightforward here. This is more of an exposition scene for us more than anything. We're not going to get into too much into the heavy, weird symbolism of we will come to know the student council for, but we have these characters discussing Saionji's treatment of Anthy, who we learn is something called the Rose Bride, and they're engaged. and there's someone or something called the end of the world who's important somehow.
Yes. And I'm glad you say that we don't get any weird symbolism, as if we don't get the infamous stopwatch here for the first time.
That's like child's play.
So, yeah, we get a stopwatch here. I don't know if we want to talk about that now, because I feel like this will be something that I feel like it has haunted Utena fandom for as long as the show has existed, and I think it will forever. But I don't think it's just something to note here. We don't have to get into
it. Something to note. It's going to come up a lot, so I think we can save it for a future episode, because yes, that is going to appear, the blue haired boy with the stopwatch is going to be very important. But no one quite knows what it means.
Yes, but it's provocative.
Yes.
So we get this scene, and here, obviously, like, the other students have a problem with how Saionji is treating Athi, but it's like, no one seems to be making a move to simply intervene. Like, no one's really intervening. Obviously, Toga did physically before, but no one's, like, there's obviously some sort of understanding that their relationship can't change. Like, so that's something to note there.
Yeah, no one's really seems concerned for, like, Auntie's well-being. It's just the rules, like, you're not supposed to do that.
And they definitely talk about her as if she is not there. No one asks Auntie her opinion at any point. It's purely, Saionji, we see how you're treating the Rose Bride. You should stop that. And it's as if she's not even there. She's just an object or just furniture to them at this point.
Yeah, and I think Saionji says something to the effect of, like, well, if you have a problem with it, duel me for her, because we learn in this scene that whoever wins, there's some sort of duel, and whoever wins the duel possesses Auntie, the Rose, but they, like, who they call the Rose Bride. And yeah, it's clear that she is in this moment not being considered as a person, but as this intermediary figure of whatever this end of the world these duels represents.
Exactly. And so this kind of leads into what we were referring to before is, like, the sort of inciting incident of essentially the entire plot of the show, which is we see this large crowd of pretty much all boys, I believe. I don't see any girls there.
I think it's all boys.
Yeah, in the scene. And so they're all looking at a love letter that's been pinned to, like, a corkboard or something. And, like, obviously, like, we are in America are familiar with the idea of a love letter, but in Japan specifically, there's this sort of, like, trope or this idea of, like, leaving your crush in school, like a love letter, like a confession. And so, like, obviously this has a big weight. It's like, I guess, similar to, like, passing notes in, like, American school. Mm-hmm. And so someone has pinned it up, and I do like that we don't know at first, like, who it is, like, how this is related to anything. But I think as soon as, like, they start talking and you see Wakaba sort of, like, just frozen in place, you instantly kind of understand. Yeah, there's that really, really heartbreaking moment where we just look at her face, like, completely frozen, then, like, a single tear, like, rolls down. Like, really fantastic stuff. And of course, Utena is instantly enraged, ready to fight anyone, someone, because we love her.
Yeah, and I will also, again, like to draw, to relate this back to, again, the idea of theater and an audience. This we have this, like, very literal audience of boys, like, making a spectacle of this love letter. And I think the crowds of students on this show, I think I'm going to be drawing attention to a lot, because, you know, we don't, even where there's not literal theater or performance happening, the unnamed students of the school are always watching. And it's that, it's, you know, Wakaba's not ashamed of having written the love letter. She's ashamed of it being seen by these students and it being made a spectacle of.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's something interesting to note, that there's always students walking around in every, like, in some anime, like, there's, you just, like, only ever see your main characters and, like, whatever. But there, well, like you said, the idea of a crowd or an audience is very present. And so it's very noteworthy whenever that stops happening, like later in the duel, when it's just those three characters, or in the student council, like we said, there's just those characters there. So yeah, that's an interesting note, this idea of being watched by a large group, faceless group, essentially.
So this is where Utena stumbles ass backwards into the plot of the show when she goes to Seonji, who's the captain of the kendo team, and she challenges him to a duel, not because she knows what the duels mean, but because he's on the kendo team. And she's like, you swords, fine, I'll fight you with a wooden sword. Cool.
Makes you wonder if he was in chess or something. Yeah. Like,
yeah, this would be a completely different show.
Absolutely.
No, yeah, she truly I love how, because when I watch the show for the first time and then watch it again, the show is just so endlessly rewatchable. And it's just so fun to, when you go back to the beginning and you remember, oh, Utena just had no clue, like she was the main character of the show and that she was stumbling into this. Because it's truly, she just does it because she cares about Wakaba, not because she's witnessed Auntie being slapped, but that's not what made her get involved in the duels. So then we cut to the Shadow Play Girls, our first.
Yes.
Us. So you chose the name of the podcast. You suggested it. So I kind of want to give it over to you to kind of like give our, like, who are these gals?
So, yeah, the Shadow Play Girls. So obviously our namesake, and that, of course, should mean that we're probably going to be seeing more of these two. And so we've been talking a lot about the idea of theater. A lot about the idea of like facelessness, so it makes sense that this show, which already I feel like has like a million different versions of the Greek chorus, mm-hmm. also has these two as like the most literal form of that. The show doesn't bother telling you like, are these real people? Who is this? What's happening? We just cut to the scene of these two silhouettes talking to each other. And they kind of give us, they start talking, I believe, about the forest, right? Give us this idea of, like, something's going down in the forest. This will become, like, a running theme. I'm excited for how ridiculous these scenes will get, more ridiculous, I should say, because it's already a very strange sort of aside that no one else in this, like, show remarks upon at any point, at least in this episode. It just is presented to us as like, yep, here's this thing that's happening, which I love.
Yeah, I remember the first time I watched this, I was kind of freaked out. Also, the dub voices for the Shadow Girls are very upsetting.
Oh, no.
It's very creepy and not good. But even it's, yeah, the music and the voices and the did you know, like it's unsettling. And I'm so excited to talk about these segments every time they come up, because there are some I have a really good grasp on what they symbolize and what they mean. And then there are some I still don't get. Like, I don't know what the fuck they're saying, but girl, I'm living. This one is pretty straightforward, though, because they're basically like, there's a hero who's fighting on behalf of her friend. There are rules in the forest, but does she know what these rules are? And that is very... Utena is going to the forest, and she doesn't know what the rules of the forest are. She's doing this duel without knowing what it means.
Exactly, yeah. And it's sort of like an echo of this voice that we get in the beginning that introduces us this tale of the princess and the prince, who like ends that little coda with the question of, but was that really such a good idea? Which is like sort of like, it's like a sort of comedic sort of question, like, well, should she really be doing all this? In here, like you said, it kind of becomes a little scary, like the way they repeat it, like not to spoil, but like a lot of the time the Shadow Play Girls are played for like a sort of comedic moment.
Yeah.
But it is still sort of ominous. Like, it is, I guess, like to bring in theater more, it's very Shakespearean, this sort of idea of like these characters who seem unrelated to the plot. Are sort of commenting on it for us and seem to know more than we do, or even more than what the characters know. I'm excited to talk about them more.
But then we cut into Utena opening the door in the forest and ascending the stairs and to the song Zute Unme Mokushiroku.
Yes.
By J.A. Caesar, and we didn't mention him in the first episode, but he's a composer that Ikahara was like a fan of, like for like since like high school or something, and he really wanted to have him involved on the show, and it was a big get for him, and so this song where she's going up the stairs and like all of the dueling music is J.A. Caesar. This song rips.
It is so insanely good. It's an instant earworm, not just because we will be hearing this song a lot, but also because it is just catchy as hell.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's just, it's so metal. And if you, again, this is a repeated sequence. It's our sort of like transformation sequence of this part of the show. And like, you know, where it's not so much a literal transformation sequence, but it is taking us to where the battle will begin.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, if we're talking about Utena as if it's a magical girl show, this is the Sailor Moon, like, twirling around sort of moment. But I do love that it sort of begins with Utena reaching out her hand. She grabs, she just, like, again, just stumbling into this. She has no clue what's going on. She's just touching shit, doesn't know what anything is going to happen. But I love her, like, reactions to things. Like, when this water splashes her, she's like, ah, it's cold. Like, she recoils at it. Like, any other character who, like, knew the significance of what's happening here probably wouldn't do that. But she, since she doesn't care or know, she's, of course, just going to, like, react or, like, exclaim things at random moments because, like, they really don't have any significance to her. So I really love that. Yeah.
Yeah, there is, it's, since you brought that up, because there was something I mentioned in the intro episode how much I love Utena's voice actress, Tomoko Kawakami, and there's an interview you can watch on YouTube with her, and where she talks about, like, auditioning for the part and how surprised she was chosen, because, like, so many of the voice actresses who auditioned for Utena kind of, if I'm remembering the interview correctly, like, played up her, like, toughness and her tomboyishness. But she played it very differently from everyone else. And the reason she was chosen was because of the way she played Utena's naivete. And that is what I think makes the character so charming. She's so kind-hearted, but has no clue what's going on. And it's those moments. And there's a moment at the end of the episode where I love where she's like, basically after the duel, we'll get to the duel in a second, but like where she's like, okay, that was weird. All right, that was a weird day.
Yeah, she's like, might as well. I believe she says like, well, I better forget about that.
Yeah, and it's just, that is what is so lovable about Utena. And I just want to draw attention to that was like why Tomoko Kawakami was picked as her voice actress because of the way she played that naivete and didn't so much focus on her heroishness and her, you know, tomboyishness, which is an important part of her. But what makes her such a great character, I think, is that the way she just kind of stumbles through this.
Absolutely,
it's such a lovely way.
Yeah, like, but I do also really love beyond that, the sort of, like we said, we've talked about this idea of the symbolism of sort of like up things, like elevation, like the idea of going up somewhere obviously is very significant. It's like symbolizing this idea of like a higher plane of existence. Obviously things are a lot more important the higher up they are. But we also get a lot of like water imagery here. Which to me, water is always a sort of symbol of like sort of transitioning from one position to another, like the idea of like moving across water. So I like that we sort of get this like these big water features going on here to sort of symbolize this idea of like crossing the threshold or going beyond the veil here.
Yeah, and also water is a symbol of like birth or rebirth. And then if we during the duel song for this episode, we look at the lyrics, it's about like being born into the world, born in an instant to repeat again. So that to me evokes baptism or what being reborn in some way. And so I think you can also connect the water imagery to that.
Yeah, well, I didn't even think about that. That's great. and we also get some bells here.
Yes.
Which clearly, I don't know who's operating the bells, but they are perfectly timed, it would seem. and yeah, to me, like, the bells, I think, could be like wedding bells when you think, because I believe the first time they sort of go off is when they introduce the idea of the Rose Bride. Mm-hmm. And so you get the ring, like the ringing of the bells there, but then we also get them in the instant that Utena wins the duel here. So I guess it's still sort of connecting the idea of wedding bells there. Like now Utena is married to the Rose Bride, supposedly, mm-hmm. even if she has no idea what that means.
Yeah, so the duel itself, so Utena gets up into the dueling arena, this platform in the sky, and she sees the upside down castle for the first time. And this is something we won't talk about too much now because all we know now is that there's an upside down castle in the sky that you can only see from the dueling arena. And Sayonji just kind of just brushes it off and calls it a mirage. That's pretty much all he has to say about it. But you'd think you'd have more to say about it because it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, clearly he's been here before, whatever, who cares? Yeah, it's the gigantic upside down castle that is a mirage. Duh, stupid. Mm-hmm. And of course Utena is like, she just rolls with it too at that point, because she's Utena. But that's something interesting to note, because castles, I think, are something everyone associates with, like, kings and queens and princesses and the royalty and, like, the fairy tale idea. So it's interesting to note that it's not just a floating castle, it's a floating upside-down castle. So I guess maybe it's asking us to sort of consider a sort of reversed fairy tale, or maybe reconsider what our idea of a fairy tale even is. At least that's how I sort of interpret the idea of an upside-down castle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so at the same time, Utena's having quite the day. She's going, well, A, learns that there's anything in the forest. B, goes up the longest flight of stairs anyone's ever gone up. And then C, sees the castle in the sky. And then D, learns that Anthea is the rose bride. Anthea has now emerged in this her gown to pin the roses to Utena and Sayonji. And again, Utena has no clue what the rose bride means or what she's gotten herself into. And the roses, all she knows is the roses remind her of her prince. By extension, remind her of her past. And Anthi wishes her luck, and Sayonji slaps Anthi. And this is where Utena is incited. And she's confused and angry, and she's like, well, I guess I have to beat him. And then the camera lingers on Anthi's face for a long time. And is she shocked, surprised, confused? I don't know, but it lingers on her in the moment where Utena resolves to beat him, seemingly because of what she's witnessed.
Yeah, it's noteworthy that that Anthi is so seemingly surprised. Like you said, we don't really know what her emotional state is, because we don't really hear a lot from her in this episode. And so, yeah, it's like, it's safe to assume no one has ever really talked about Anthi in this way, or she's like, the idea of someone defending her honor or in any way or defending her at all is clearly very new to her, which is noteworthy. So, yeah, which instantly it's a very sad existence. I think that much is at least clear from what we can tell. And so not only is she involved in all this, but also, by the way, she has a sword inside of her, apparently.
Yeah, so this is the first time we hear from this, her evoke the word Dios, for the power of Dios that sleeps within me. And Sayonji pulls a sword from her chest while saying, let this grant me to take, I can't remember the exact
the
word.
The power to bring to the world revolution.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so she's had a sword in her chest this whole time. And Utena thinks the sword is also a mirage. This is one time where I'll definitely defend Utena's like obliviousness. Like, you've never seen someone pull a sword out of someone's chest. And she's having quite the day. Exactly. But yeah, he literally pulls the source of his power for this duel from Anthi's chest. She's got some sort of power.
Right.
Like Utena, we're in the same place as Utena. We have no clue what's going on.
Right. You can forgive her for it's a mirage, because apparently ridiculous things can just be written off that way, according to Sayonji. So yeah, it makes sense that she would just not really care. Like, she would just accept that at face value. It's interesting, this idea of pulling a sword out of a person, because I think, obviously, there's a lot to say about the idea of the sword as a phallic symbol. That is, we've all, like, that's just sort of a given whenever you're talking
like,
about
we get sword. It.
But it's interesting that we get a literal human as the sheath to a sword, and a character who, as we've seen, has been literally objectified by everyone around her this whole time. So it's interesting to see that she's literally just used as a vessel or as a sheath in this moment, which is if a sword is a sort of male sort of thing, object, then I presumably we could say, not to get into like binarism, but it's like a sort of a female sort of figure would be like the sheath, I guess.
I mean, and Anthi is a part of the stool, like she pins the roses and the sword is pulled from her, but she is not an active participant in it. She needs to be there for it to happen. But she is not the one actually acting, other than pinning the roses. You know, it's a very, you know, yes, that is an act of gesture, but that's not, you know, the same as sword fighting.
Right. That's her duty. She pins the rose on you. And then she stands back and allows the two to sort of dictate her fate. I talked about the idea we don't really hear much from Antti, but what we do hear from her is almost like she's reading from a script. These characters are sort of doing these like incantations almost to activate these powers. So it's still hard to get a grip on the idea of who Antti is as a character beyond just being the girl with the sword in her chest. So it'll be interesting to see if Utena can bring that out of her in future episodes.
Mm-hmm. So in this duel, I had forgotten that this first duel, Utena's using a wooden sword. And it breaks. And this is, of course, the moment where she realized that the sword of Dios is real and not a mirage. And Seonji's kind of, I can't remember exactly what he says, but he's kind of, you know, taunting her a bit about, you know, that she's like, I can't remember exactly, but like she's dressed like a prince and, you know, she's a girl in this duel. But even with her stump of a wooden sword, she defeats Seonji, who has the sword of Dios, which all we know is it's very powerful, and he just pulled it from a person's chest, some magical power. And even with a stump of a sword, she beats him. And I love the way the duels on the show are choreographed, and I just love that the moment of like where they're charging at each other, and then the reveal that of whose rose has fallen.
Yeah, it's really, really, like you said, really well choreographed. And we get this great sort of moment of just as Utena's like lunging, we kind of get this freeze frame of just her hair, like the strands of her hair that are trailing behind her as she lunges forward. And then we get a reminder of the flashback to the words the prince said to her. We can assume, I guess, these are the words going through her mind in this moment. That's sort of her motivation here, is that she's going to be a prince here, presumably to Antti's princess figure. Mm-hmm. So it's just interesting to note that we get that little moment here right before we get that nice big the slashing of the colors, the green on the pink, and then we get
which wicked is like tease.
It's very, yes. please, yes, where was Kristen Chenoweth for the dub casting? Like, come on.
Oh my god, yeah. Ooh.
She we'll could talk really
about this. We'll have to talk about this as we go along, where the original Broadway cast of Wicked would have fallen into the Utena dub cast.
Absolutely. But where does Rachel Berry from Glee play into all this is what I'm wondering. So we get the great, it's sort of like a classic anime moment of like the slashing of the sword and it's nothing personal, kid sort of moment. And then we see that Utena is victorious in this moment, like we said, with her little stump of a sword, but even with, like, there's something definitely to read into there about the idea of, like, sort of having structural power versus not, and even with all of this sort of, like, weight behind Seonji, he has the sort of Dios, he has all the knowledge here, and even then, he still can't beat Utena. It's just something to note there about this idea of, like, power in that moment.
Yeah, and I wanted to also note, when she has that flash of the prince's words in her head, I think it's really important to note that she's hearing her own child's voice. She's not hearing the prince speak. She's hearing herself as a child remembering the words. And that, I think, is something I, again, didn't make note of. It's not that I didn't notice it on previous watches. I just wasn't taking notes about it. I was like, oh, that's interesting. She's not hearing the voice of the prince. She's hearing the voice of herself as a child.
Right, exactly. Like, we still don't know who this prince is. We haven't seen a character who looks like this, like lavender hair. We haven't really seen a character who looks like this in the show yet. So for all we know, it's not even a real person. It's like, we just don't know who this prince is. But like you said, it's a figure that plays very large in Utena's mind, and specifically her child mind. Like, we aren't hearing her in her current voice. It's her child's. Like you said, so just something to note there. Mm-hmm. So we get the rose falls, and now presumably Utena and Antti are betrothed. That's what we've been led to believe. And so, like we said, though,
Auntie calls Sayonji classmate.
Yes,
senpai.
Yes, we get that little moment of switching from she's been calling him Sayonji-sama this whole time, and suddenly it's Sayonji-senpai, which he just is totally floored by. And it's good to note that he is also just flat on the floor. She is in a position above him, like just the ultimate slap to the face. Great moment from like it's like after a scene, Auntie get like hit multiple times and kind of being like a prize to be won, she still gets that little, whether it's intentional or not, she still gets that little barb in at the very end, which is just so satisfying to get there. Because Sayonji's a dick. It's okay to say that.
Yeah, Sayonji sucks. then we cut to Toga with his little, literal like theater glasses you like took to the theater like in the 19th century or whatever, watching from a distance, spectating from the distance, I put. And he's watching this happen, and he says, "Oh, baby," in English, and then says, "Like you've lit a fire in my heart," and I don't know why he says baby.
Yeah,
I think it's so funny.
It is pretty damn iconic. And it's even funnier to think about this as like a 17-year-old boy doing this. Presumably, like you said, we don't really know why he says it in English other than to just make us be more weirded out by him, or and using the idea of like lighting up a fire. It's almost like invoking like Elvis or like old school sort of like I love songs. So we don't really, presumably he's talking about Utena in that moment. So, it's interesting to note that Toga, one, saw this all go down and now has an interest in Utena in some way.
Yeah, because we talked about, it's very deliberate that like this duels don't take in front of a take place in front of an audience. You would think out of everything on the show, the duels would take place in front of the audience. You think about like medieval, like jousting and like, you know, things that like, you know, or, you know, duels, typically we think people are watching them. And then the show, usually they aren't, but then, you know, we think no one's watching, but we see in the distance, Toga is watching, and he's making some sort of, the wheels are turning, and it's impacting him in some way, even though they did not know he was watching.
Exactly. Yeah, we don't know if Sayonji planned, like, we don't know if this is how every duel goes, but all we know now is that Toga has seen this transfer of the Rose Bride. And Utena, I guess, just is like, okay, bye, y'all. That was fun. Did
yeah,
that.
Yeah, she's like, okay, cool. Had a little sword fight. That was fun. So I got basketball tomorrow. Yeah, she's walking around the campus at night. She's literally like, anyway, so, like, that was weird. Weird day. But, yeah, it has made no impact on her. She's clearly not understood a single thing that just happened until she runs into Auntie, who says, I've been waiting for you. And calls her Utena-sama and says that I belong to you now. And that's where we end the episode.
Yeah. Like you said, this is a really fantastic pilot to me. Like, this is a great introduction for the show because it gives you a lot. We are introduced to the characters. You get a good sense of who the characters are. It's just like a lot of the stuff that happens is very confusing, intentionally so. But you still understand the emotional stakes going on here, enough to hopefully be intrigued and wonder where this all goes from here. Because like, maybe in a traditional sort of fairy tale, you'd be waiting for Utena to save Auntie. Like that's the big goal of the show. Maybe you would think going in, but this is the end of the first episode, and we've already saved the princess from the evil guy. So like, where does the show go from here? I think it's an interesting question that the show is asking us. And I can't wait to find out more.
Yeah. So, I mean, how do we want to wrap this up? I mean, it's a great episode. I love this episode so much.
Yeah. I don't know if we want to like rank episodes as we go. I don't know if that's too reductive or whatever, but that was going to be like my original sort of, thing I was going to ask you, like, if you're like talking about this as an episode of television, what do you like? Great episode, good episode, A+, B+, what?
I think it's fantastic. I think it's definitely in the A to A+ category for me in terms of when you think of it as just a fantastic first episode for a show in terms of it's so economical. You know, these episodes are so short, and we're talking about, you know, there's so much to talk about. We could, and if we were doing this podcast as a spoiler podcast, we could talk about this episode for like 2 hours. Yeah. That's also kind of part of partially why I wanted to do a more spoiler free one, because to kind of restrict us, because when you've seen the whole show and then you return to it, there's so much to talk about, and it's so, again, economical in terms of what, who it introduces us to and how. Again, I love that we have to wait just a little bit to meet Utena in the present, and like, you know, we first see her in the past, and then we know we meet Wakaba, and we know Utena's clearly, we assume Utena's clearly some great presence in her life. But then I love how it does kind of subvert certain expectations we might have about the show right off the bat, because we know Utena is a hero of the show. The show is called Revolution Girl Utena. She's got pink hair, this crazy outfit that no one else is wearing. She wants to be a prince, and she's noble, but like, she again stumbles into this, and she doesn't really want to, she doesn't do it to save Anthy. It's something else. And I like that it's already kind of complicating our idea of like what the story of the show might be. And it's a great ending to, like, I can't imagine not wanting to watch the next episode and figure out where do we go from here.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I agree. This is a really, really great introduction for the show. We haven't really talked about the actual opening of the show.
Oh my God, yeah, I wanted to talk about it, but then we just drove right into it. I'm so excited. The greatest, like, opening theme ever.
Yeah, like, we talked about the music, but yeah, the opening is a huge, huge banger, and it also introduces a lot of visuals that, like, for sure off the bat may seem confusing or, but I feel like if you're an anime fan, you're used to that idea of, like, this will become significant later, don't know who that is, whatever. But I think that's just, there's a lot of imagery in the opening of Utena that is very significant, and I don't know how much of it we could talk about other than the fact that it does, like, give us good flashes of, like, these different color-coded characters engaged in duels, it seems like. We get some flying horses. Christine was delighted to be introduced to a great nugget of Utena fandom, which is Horse Utena. Highly recommend just go to YouTube, type in Horse Utena.
We can put it on Twitter.
Yeah, I'll link it in when we post the episode. But this is just a fantastic, amazing musically and visually opening for the show. And it's just, like, part of, I feel like there's, like, a thousand different things you could call sort of, like, the theme song of the show, like Absolute Apocalypse, whatever. Like, that's kind of an opening for the show. Like, music is a great, music and repetition in particular, just, like, these great sort of parts, aspects of the show that I love. So that's something I also am looking forward to tracking as we keep going through the show.
Yes, there's a few. I absolutely adore the use of music on the show, and even more so in the movie. I'm excited for when we eventually, many months, weeks and months from now, talk about the movie, because, like, the use of music in the movie is, like, some of the greatest use of music in any movie ever, in my opinion. But the music in the show is so great. What pieces of music are repeated and when are, it's very significant and thought out, and what these, and especially a note for our new viewers with the dueling theme song, the dueling songs that are going to come up. It's kind of like, I know, like, when I first was watching, especially, like, with the subs, you're like, should I be reading the dialogue of the duel or reading the dueling lyrics? And I definitely highly recommend reading the dialogue that's happening in the duel, at least on your first watch. And we'll definitely try to talk about the lyrics of the duel when we do these episodes, because lyrics of the duel are important. There's things you can interpret from them. Like, again, I think this first duel song is very much about rebirth and perhaps Utena being born into this weird new world, being baptized, mm-hmm. you know, the water into this weird new world where she doesn't know what's going on. But I also think these duel songs serve a similar function to, like, the Shadow Girls, and in terms of, like, they're kind of offering a different interpretation of what's going on in the episode, whereas the duel lyrics are similarly, through music, offering interpretation of what's going on with these characters.
For sure. Yeah, we get this the line that jumped out to me in the song this time was, I believe there's a line like, I'm an actor forever, yeah. Metaphorical, something along those lines.
I have the lyrics, and it's, I'm an actor cast eternally, And then in another verse, and I am an actor cast. Yeah, actually just repeats that. Never mind. I am an actor cast eternally in the cradle of eternal bliss.
This idea of acting, performance, theater, these are good sort of themes to look to going forward. Do you want to tell, like, I believe next week, are we watching two episodes?
Yes, I have the spreadsheet open, Derek.
Yes.
So for the little behind the scenes thing, I made a color-coded spreadsheet for this podcast, and I had a lot of fun with it. So yeah, we will be doing it. There will be a few episodes of the pod where we will be doing two episodes at a time. There are some episodes of the show that are very much two-parters. And there are some that just make sense thematically to discuss at the same time, I think. And next week, we will be doing two episodes. We will be doing the second and the third episode, For Whom the Rose Smiles and On the Night of the Ball. This is not a two-parter in the same way that some others are, but these are our kind of like, we had our premiere, and then these are our kind of second and third episode world building episodes. And I just think it makes sense to dive into them together, because then the following two episodes are a two-parter that's very character heavy. So I think it'd be good to kind of dive into those world building episodes together before we get into the character studies of the show.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Something I always think about is because I'm me, I think about Community and the DVD commentary of Community. There's, I believe Dan Harmon, the creator of that show, talks about this idea of like the pilot of a show, or the idea of like the first, I think the number he uses is like the first six or seven episodes of a show should kind of be a pilot in a way. And so I do think that this show has kind of that sort of structure, at least for these first few episodes, where we are kind of getting introduced to a lot of new things in one episode. Like you said, world building is like a big part of those, but those character sort of moments also kind of feel like pilots too, in a way. So I think, we all hail the spreadsheet. I trust the spreadsheet with my life. It's a holy text. And I'm excited. And obviously we'll let people know at the end of the pod. And I also, maybe like on the Twitter, we'll make sure to remind people what episodes, remind people their homework for next week's, so they know what we're talking about next time. Any other closing thoughts on The Rose Bride, episode one of Revolutionary Girl Utena?
Not quite, but I don't think so. But I think we kind of, I'm looking at my notes. I think we covered like literally everything I wanted to talk about. Oh, I did want to just mention that this is the only episode that Ikahara has an individual credit for. He did this. This is the only episode that he's credited for storyboards on. And so again, which we talked about in the intro episode, he still obviously had a lot of influence. And then I didn't get to mention that the director of this episode was Toru Takahashi, who's another Evangelion alum. He did, he's an animator in Evangelion, but this was his first, Utena was his first time directing, and he directed 10 episodes of the show, so we're going to come back to him a lot. And this was one was written by Yoshi Enokido, who is the one who, individual who wrote like 20 of the 39 episodes.
Nice. So, perfect. Yeah.
I'll try to do those at the top. But I got so excited to talk about Wakaba calling Utena her boyfriend.
That is like we did not want to bury the lead there. That is very significant. Yeah, I feel like we haven't really talked about, I think it's because we are both gay that we just like, that's just like our natural sort of state. Like, yeah, duh, of course she's calling her boyfriend. Like, but I feel like we're kind of unintentionally sort of like blowing past the sort of queer elements here, but I do think that that's sort of gonna be like a running theme in the show, of like, if you're like a young, especially me who grew up in rural Illinois, I don't know where you sort of grew up, Christine, I know we're kind of from the same area, but like when you're a closeted young person and you're watching the show for the first time, those moments that we're kind of like brushing past are huge. I remember first watching this show and being like, oh my god, what, like this whole show is about two women presumably being engaged in some way. Don't let us be like that's just background noise to us at this point. Don't let that be like feel like us downplaying it in any way. So I guess going forward, I try to maybe point those moments out more if we can.
Oh yeah, I mean, I don't think there's going to be a concern about me like not talking about the gay shit in the show. I was more holding off on it because the next episode is where we learn more about, where we're really introduced to Anthea and Utena now in this state of betrothedness. Don't worry. Oh my God. When we get to certain episodes, I'm going to have pages and pages on notes on the homosexuality of it all. So.
Good. Yeah. As if I'm saying it as if we're not called the Shadow Play Gaze, and that's like the first thing you see of this, but I just want to make sure that people know what you mean. Listening, like, that's kind of the framing that we're coming at this from. Like, we talked about this kind of in the intro episode, but there's definitely people out there who do not read in that the show in that way at all. They outright refuse to see any sort of queer subtext or text or anything, which to it is just homophobic. Like, we joke about the idea of homophobic, like, that's homophobic, blah blah blah, but that is actively homophobic to pretend like this show is not trying to talk about a romantic relationship between two female characters. Mm-hmm. Don't get it twisted.
Don't get it twisted. It's gay, honey.
Yes.
So, Derek, where can people find you?
Yes. Well, you can find me at Rain Dierks on Twitter. You can follow my other podcast, Bitter Jurors Pod, which is, we are so kind. I'm saying that as if I'm not also part of that Bitter Jurors. this is sort of kind of going to be like a Bitter Jurors Presents situation here with the Shadowplay Gaze, since this is kind of like a limited series. But yeah, you can find me there. Christine has been a guest on Bitter Jurors Pod before. Will probably be a guest again.
As I hope so.
hopefully talking about gay shit on there too. You never know. Maybe one day. But Bitter Jurors Pod on Twitter and Instagram. And yeah, Christine, what about you? Where can people find you?
Yeah, I am on Twitter at @xteen_files. And I have Instagram as well at @thexteenfiles. I don't use Instagram as much. And then if you're also like Survivor and you want to read me write about it, I write about it on Inside Survivor. So you can look at Inside Survivor and look up my name, Christine Palin, and see all the things I've written.
Oh yeah, and obviously we now have a Twitter account, Shadowplay Gaze, where we will be announcing episodes, but also on Bitter Jurors Pod, I'm sure I'll be like retweeting stuff there too, just to make sure that everyone is aware, so that people who listen to Bitter Jurors aren't like, what is this? What's going on? Why is all this pink here? Just to make sure there's no confusion there. Thank you, Christine, for talking about The Rose Bride with me, and I can't wait to keep doing it for 38 episodes in a movie.
I'm so excited. This is so fun. We're gonna go on such a journey.
Absolutely.
And yeah, thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you everyone for listening. Bye.
Bye.